Good afternoon. It's great to see so many people here. That's a good sign. I'm Susie Gelman. I'm a past president of the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington, and I'm current co-chair of JFNA's IREP, Israel Religious Expressions Platform. So welcome to my hometown, and I hope you're enjoying this glorious fall weather. This is typical November weather for Washington. I wish. So let's get started. Israel has always been a mosaic of complex religious and ethnic identities, and supporting a strong, safe, and democratic Israeli state for all of her citizens has been an essential part of Federation's mission for decades. Today, we continue to work with Israelis to fulfill the guarantees in the Israeli Declaration of Independence of social and political equality for all of its citizens. Federation supports several initiatives that aid religious and ethnic minorities, in particular Israeli Arabs and Ethiopian Jews, as well as Israelis whom we don't always consider as having less than full access to fundamental rights, such as the right to marry legally in keeping with one's religious beliefs and core values. We're honored today to welcome representatives from these groups. They'll share their personal stories and describe how they are working to build better lives for themselves and for their communities with the support of the Federation system. Here to talk about efforts of the Ethiopian National Project and other organizations working to advance the integration of Israel's Ethiopian Jewish community is the chairman of the Immigration, Absorption, and Diaspora Affairs Committee and only Ethiopian-Israeli member of the current Knesset, Dr. Avraham Nagosa of the Likud. JFNA's Social Venture Fund for Jewish, Arab Equality, and Shared Society in Israel has allocated more than $6.5 million to agencies and projects that benefit Arab citizens of Israel since its founding in 2007. Bashayer Fahum Jayusi, an Arab-Israeli attorney and co-chair of the Abraham Fund Initiatives, will speak about the challenges facing her community and efforts to increase equality of opportunity being supported by federations. With us also is Miki Gitson, executive director of Israel Chofshit, a nonprofit focused on advocating for official recognition by the Israeli government of diverse expressions of Judaism. Our moderator is Rabbi Dr. Naftali Rotenberg, an Israeli thinker and writer on issues of religion and state, democracy, and Jewish law. Before I invite Miki to begin the session, I'm supposed to promote the GA game, so I'm going to do that now. You can win a free trip to Israel by downloading the app from the App Store, turn on Bluetooth, and earn points by checking in to each session and taking a survey afterwards. So the survey will appear in the session description on the app once this session is over. The GA app is useful for other reasons besides playing the game, but anyway. It's now my pleasure to invite our first guest, our first speaker, Miki Gitson, to the podium, but I'll admit. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, I'm the co-chair, along with Kim Hyman of Cincinnati, of JFNA's IREP initiative, which was created to advance Jewish pluralism in Israel, starting with promoting freedom of choice of marriage. I often hear that it seems like the North American Jewish community cares deeply about issues of pluralism and religious diversity in Israel, but people sometimes wonder where, beyond the streams, are our Israeli partners. I'm proud to introduce one such partner, Miki Gitson. Through Israel Chofshit, Miki is working on the ground to mobilize young, secular Israelis to pursue their rights to independent Jewish expression in the ways that are most meaningful to them. And this change is emanating from the ground up. I'd also like to just say a personal word or two about Miki. I've been involved with civil society in Israel for a long time. And at times I, like I imagine some others in this audience, get discouraged about where Israel is headed. But people like Miki inspire me and give me hope. They're the ones, like all of our panelists, who are on the ground, working hard and investing their time, energy, and passion to make their ideals, the ideals of the founders of the state, a reality. Mickey, we commend you and your colleagues for all of your efforts and look forward to hearing your perspective today. Thank you.
Wow, thank you, Susie. I'm very flattered about what you just said, and I'm very excited to stand here. Thank you, everyone, for coming here. It's a great privilege to be standing here and talking about my work in Israel Chofshit. In the last 6 years in Israel Chofshit, we've been working hard in mobilizing the Israeli public into issues of religious freedom, freedom of religion. We were one of the first organizations in the field that realized the ability to mobilize Israelis, but actually not only, through online work, but working with the people on the ground, getting us Israelis, young ones, to talk and speak what do we care about. And one of the things that we really care about is our personal identity. I usually don't read the weekly parsha. I don't go to synagogue in Israel. I would what people call in Israel secular Israeli. But when I come here to the States, I happen find myself speaking actually in a Reform temple or conservative shul, or sometimes I even had the opportunity to speak in an Orthodox synagogue. And I read this Shabbat's parsha, and I was reading through Chayei Sarah, through Sarah's life, and I was looking at what's going on there, and I saw the switch or the shift in generations. And being a quite young social activist, the issue of shifting generations actually quite appears to be interesting to me. And I saw how the generation that immigrated to Israel, to the land of Israel, Abraham and Sarah, are dying through the Parsha, and the younger generation taking over. And I'm looking at this panel actually here and see the diverse group of people sitting in this room and sitting in this panel, and understanding that Israel is changing. The generation that immigrated to Israel, led by David Ben-Gurion, the Prime Minister of Israel, that was trying to create one kind of Israeli, the Israeli that was born out of the sea, that has no roots, that became something that was not around before that, is actually not the Israeli that I'm part of. You know, growing up in a Russian-speaking family, my entire life is actually becoming not a Russian anymore, preventing speaking Russian. I barely speak Russian today, but I really wanted to be Israeli. But today I know that actually the cultures and the languages and the colors and the flavors of our society, it's actually what makes us stronger. And you can look at it from a cultural aspect, but you can also look at it from institutional aspects. One of the institutions that keeps this kind of unified Jewish identity, which is not diverse, which is monopolized by one kind of thinking, is the legal institution of the rabbinate. Today in Israel, as probably many of you know, there is only one legal way to be Jewish. There is one way you can get married. There is only one way you can divorce. There is one way that the majority of us can be buried by. And many of us, culturally and socially, follow these lines because it's the same way I grew up. You're either Jewish, meaning religious, or very secular. It wasn't up until actually I came here to the United States about 10 years ago, and my first boss is sitting somewhere here in the room. She's adding a federation now. To South Bend, Indiana, not exactly here, that I realized that you can be a progressive person, but at the same time Jewish, actually to draw upon this tradition to your other values. But the Israeli society is becoming more diverse, but the rabbinical system getting more and more extreme and getting us to understand that many of us have no room within the tent of Jewish life in Israel. I can just tell you the story of a couple that came to us in Israel Chofshit about a year ago, both of them from Hadera. Her name is Marina, his name is Tom. She was born in the Ukraine, actually quite close to where my dad was born, but this is always the case. She came to Israel when she was 2 years old, and he was born in Hadera himself, son of Moroccan Jews, people who immigrated from Morocco. She grew up completely Jewish, Israeli Jewish, went to the army, did a pre-army program of Jewish studies, actually. Knew for her entire life that if her last name is Wasserman, she must be Jewish. She was actually one of those that didn't know that her mother was not halachically Jewish. Actually, she doesn't know it till today. Because she couldn't prove the fact that her mother was halachically Jewish. Her grandma was not around to speak Yiddish with the rabbis. Yeah, and this is the way you should prove that you're Jewish today in Israel. And she didn't have any ketubah or anything to prove with that she's Jewish because she grew up, or her parents grew up in Soviet Union, in the communist Soviet Union. So you look at this person who is an Israeli, a full citizen of the state of Israel, immigrated to Israel with the help of you guys. You remember the days that you stood there with Shlachet Ami, prevented from basic human rights in any democracy. So they found their way. They got married through an alternative and then flew to Fiji, actually, to get married and to be recognized by the state of Israel. But it's not only the story of Tom and Marina. It's the story of the Jewish identity of the state of Israel. Will Israel be the home of all Jews around the world? And the non-Jews, of course, will live with us. Or it's going to keep being a place that there is only one perception of Jewish life which is allowed. But it's not only about them. It's about the LGBTQ community. I was myself amazed to see here at the GA Deborah Messing standing there talking about the LGBTQ rights and in the GA, the mainstream organization of the Jewish life. It made me excited. It doesn't happen in Israel today. Gay people can go and get married outside of Israel and to be recognized, but the state of Israel that hands out pamphlets of how amazing gay life in Israel does not allow these people, us, to get married in Israel. And it's the story also of Noah, who was refused of a get. She was a chained woman by her husband. Couldn't keep on with her life, although her husband went on 10 years ago. But it's also the story of this community, of the Jewish community here in the United States. I just read recently a very interesting study made by the JPPI. Shmuel Rosner did it. He drove through the American Jewish community and also outside of America and asked the young generation of American Jews, what alienates you the most from the state of Israel? And the answer was clear. It wasn't the Palestinians. It was not the war with Iran. It was one thing. It was the fact that their rabbis are not recognized by the state of Israel. It is the fact that they, most of them, cannot actually prove they were Jewish if they wanted to get married in Israel. So they, you know, go to camp and they're at Nifty or Young Judea or at the Masorti movement things and they're raised to be Zionists and they even go on birthright. But then, when they need to face reality or to understand what Israel it is, they really realize that they are not really welcome. So we have our part, and our part is very important. But our story is not an Israeli story, it's a Jewish story. And we do it almost every day, but I ask you to do the same. Next time that you meet an Israeli member of Knesset, the Israeli prime minister, ask him, you want my support. I want to support you, but how come my Judaism is not recognized? How come my Jewish path, the path that I invested so much in, is not part of the Jewish story in Israel? Switching generations allows us to do switching thinking and switching reality. And this is what we're doing today. 67 years after the state of Israel is established, it's about to open up the tent. There are too many of us who cannot get into the tent. 350,000 Russian Jews. More, about the same number of people were not willing to get into the Rabbanut because of their own reasons. Reform Jews, Masorti Jews. We see one of my great partners, Izar Es from the Masorti movement, sits here with us. It's time for us to act, and I think that we really need you in this action because we can't do it by ourselves. Thank you so much.
Rabbi Dr. Naftali Rotenberg, please. There's rules here.
My friend, I feel very privileged for two reasons. First of all, I look over you in the room, and I realized that I know and I met at least 60-70% of the people who are present here. But the interesting thing, Susie, listen to this, that I met them in separate, totally separate sessions in the GAs and in the federations and in the missions in Israel. Sessions that dealt with freedom in marriage in Israel or issues of personal status, religion and state, and so this separate session. Other that I met them on the issue of the commitment of the Jewish majority to the equality of the Arab minority. It's a different community. And others that I met them in issue of absorption and status of Jewish minorities within the Israel fabric. And you, Susie, have mentioned this before. And thank to you, we see all of you together because we speak about the same democracy. And our main challenge, it's first of all, of course, it's a political issue, but not only political issue. It's the roots are long educational process. And our main challenge, you know, here you don't say problems, you say challenge, you know. Our main problem is that we don't have a common civic vocabulary, a common democratic language. We don't share it. You know, in this state, you cross in Chula Vista, the border, and go till the Niagara Falls, you have, you know, so many communities, but people are educated from early age till the end to speak the same. It's a simple language, but to speak the same language. We don't share the same vocabulary. So this is, I think, the first teaching that we can take even in this point from this session. I want to say something personal to you, Susie, that we have met. It's important because I am in, Evelyn can say about it and many others, I am in a discussion, long discussion for dozens of years for federation's leaders. And there is a huge debate. Are we to take a position in our civic involvement or not? And I think that you are one of the people. I remember you talked to me in this, in GA, I think it was in Baltimore a few years ago. You are taking a position. You have your position. And in civil society activities, people have positions, contradict positions, but they have positions. So let's take it in consideration, and thank you for raising this issue. And without, and of course I want to thank Miki Gitzin, and I learned from you, and thank you very much. And it is my privilege and honor to invite Knesset member Dr. Avraham Negosa. He is the chairman of the absorption of the committee in the Knesset. And we want to hear you, please.
Thank you very much. It is a privilege for me to be here. And thank you for this opportunity. The title is This is My Land, This is Your Land. And certainly this is truly my land, which is the state of Israel. The land of Israel is my land. 30 years ago, 1985, I made Aliyah to Israel with my wife and one daughter, and then we had another daughter in Israel. I born in Ethiopia and grew up as a child in a very remote village in Ethiopia. I grew up as a shepherd, and my parents sent me a long distance to school to walk. In Ethiopia, it was not possible to get education in those times in every village areas. So I have to walk 22 kilometers. If every weekend I have to come back home. After finishing high school, I made Aliyah to Israel. In Israel, I have received an opportunity to join universities, academic study. I joined the Hebrew University. In Hebrew University, I was able to complete first and second degree in social work, and later law, business administration, and PhD in education. And today, I am one of the lawmakers of the State of Israel. My story is the story of the State of Israel. The State of Israel established 67 years ago to be a home for every Jew from the four corners of the earth. Here, as I am one of the thousands of Jews who immigrated to Israel, supported and helped by Israel, given the equal opportunities, received education, and reached to where I am now. Therefore, this land is my land, and my community kept its identity and dreamed and prayed next year to Jerusalem for 2,500 years. And this community paid and suffered and paid their own lives, also some of them, when they walked on foot, by foot to Israel, to Jerusalem, and finally made it to Jerusalem. And today, 140,000 Ethiopian Jews are proud citizens of the State of Israel. And 52,000 of them born in Israel. When we arrived in Israel, the Israeli people received us with warm welcome, and we were accepted. However, as a result of the community came from a traditional society to a modern technological society, the integration process is not easy. There are many challenges. And these challenges became undermining the community's life and also the Israeli society to accept the community and overcome all the challenges. Some of the challenges are employment problems and education, as there is educational gap, and some of them also as the community is concentrated and gathered in disadvantaged neighborhoods in different cities that make it difficult on education systems. So when we see that, the educational gap that affected also the employment problems and other social integration problems. Therefore, what is the solution? The solution is a key factor is education. When the community received education, there is a possibility of joining the elite faculties in the universities and acquired professions, good professions, which they can get employment. Therefore, the education programs that run today, the non-informal education run by ENP, Ethiopian National Project, which is a joint venture between the Israeli government and the federations, that started to make a difference. Those children received the programs in the ENP are making a difference. The recent matriculation result, which is evaluated by Brockdale Institute, shows that those children who are receiving these programs are receiving above the national average. When the national average is 68%, these children received 72%. So it shows the difference. We have about 10,000 who are not included with the programs. So the government now initiated a program and just approved a special budget in order to increase this kind of programs, which I am sure also the federations will respond positively to support and joining the Israeli government's initiative. Therefore, I want to say thank you for the federation system. Thank you for the American Jewish community, for the vital role you played on our immigration to Israel. You changed the dream and the vision of thousands of Ethiopian Jews into a reality which now we are proud of citizens of Israel. We have doctors, we have medical students, we have in all parts of the Israeli life system, we are trying to integrate and joining the Israeli society to build and to be built. So we are very happy for being in the land of Israel. So the land of Israel is my land. Thank you for hearing me.
And thank you, Knesset member, Dr. Avraham Negosa. And it is my honor and privilege to invite Advocate Bashaer Fahum Jayosi, the co-chair of the Abraham Fund Initiatives. Please.
Thank you and good afternoon to all. Thank you for having me. I'm a Palestinian and an Israeli citizen. I'm the proud mother of two wonderful daughters. I miss so much. They couldn't be with me here. I'm a native of Nazareth in the Galilee. I come from a deeply rooted Nazarene family that has been living in the city for centuries now. Two of my great-grandparents were mayors of the city. One of them, actually my direct great-grandfather, was the parliamentary representative of the then north of Palestine in the Ottoman parliament. As most of the Arab community in Israel, I have strong family ties with Palestinians in the occupied territories and around the world. From my mother's side, most of the family resides in the West Bank, and since 1967, they reside in different parts of the world. I'm also an Israeli citizen and a part of the Israeli society. Every aspect of my everyday life, my personal life, my professional life, my public work, everything really, is so deeply intertwined into Israeli society. Moreover, my future, my children's future, is so deeply invested in making the Israeli society a more diverse and democratic society for the good of all. As I said, born and raised in Nazareth, I had little, if any, meaningful encounters with Jews growing up. My first deep encounter with my Jewish peers was when I studied law at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And whereas I spoke what I thought then was fluent Hebrew, it wasn't so fluent, I came to learn. And living in Israel, the everyday life, you experience the Jewish narrative that is manifested in every aspect of Israeli life. So I kind of knew more or less about my Jewish peers. But to my surprise, it was that I then discovered that the majority of the Jewish community is completely oblivious of my narrative, of my heritage, some to my mere existence, unless it is magnified through security binoculars. Even though Arabic is an official language in Israel, very few Jews speak Arabic. After graduation, I'm trying to make a long story short, somehow I succeeded in, relatively succeeded professionally, in a majority Jewish environment. The challenge here is really complex, I have to say, because I'm a woman, I'm a Palestinian, I'm a Muslim, and I live in the state of Israel. I'm an Israel citizen. That is not an easy combination. So, given that, I did well. But my story, though it is, it marks the stories of some Palestinians, Israeli citizens. It's not the story of the majority of the Arab community in Israel. It is not so because few can really make the jump into working in and with Jewish society. And the two populations remain, for the most part, separate and segregated. Before exploring into the reasons that I think are for that, I want to maybe present a little background information for some of you that might not be familiar with it. In Israel, 20% of the citizen population are Arabs, Palestinians, 80% Muslim, 10% Christian, and 10% Jews. The main density of population are in the north and in the south, but the majority of Arabs live separately, in separate towns and villages. It wasn't part of my presentation, but M.K. Nagusa, just presented us that he had to go 3 kilometers in order to get an education in Ethiopia. I'm afraid that is the truth today in Israel for some of the Bedouin community living in the Negev and 40 unacknowledged villages, that they have to go on foot, sometimes 2-3 kilometers just to go to school. There are many barriers why and reasons why this is the reality in Israel. In short, and this is really going to be in headlines, there is, of course, as I said, the language barrier, the separate school list system, the separate living. Also, there is always in the background the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And yet, when we hit another dead end in the conflict, it arouses and the suspicion and the mistrust between the Jewish and the Arab populations, even inside Israel. We had a very bad experience with that in the recent crisis in Israel. Third is there's a kind of policy that the state has had for decades of segregation, unequal allocation, and underbudgeting for the Arab community, and alienation from decision-making. The viewing of the Arab citizen is mostly as a security threat. I'll go rapidly over some statistics that concern education because I don't have much time left, because education is a very dear subject to my heart and something that we do a lot about in the Abraham Fund. Statistics in recent years show that the annual investment in high school student, in a Jewish high school student, is about 30% more than an Arab high school student. That manifests itself in the statistics of the High Education Council in Israel that shows that while 55% of high school students, Jewish students, are eligible and entitled to a bagrut, that's matriculation in Israel, a certificate, only a frightening 31% of the Arab high school students are entitled to the same certificate. There is 40% unemployment among 18 to 24-year-old Arabs. This is what we call the invisible age, the invisible generation. Only 34% of Arab women are employed, and that digit actually doubled over the last decade. Poverty is double in Arab society than in general society. Only 4% of industrial areas are in Arab towns. Though there is, of course, spots of light, during the past decade and a half, there has been a growing awareness from the governments of Israel, different governments of Israel, about the gaps and the historical inequality. And steps have been taken to try and bridge upon these gaps. So many money has been invested in education, economic empowerment, employment, and infrastructure. Still not enough. Now we know that there's a plan, a new plan, with the Minister of Finance and the Joint List. That's the party representing the Arab population in Knesset that is talking about allocating really large scales of money also into bridging the gaps. But is economic welfare enough? Probably not. What's missing? What's missing is a solid sense of mutual acceptance and respect built on mutual understanding of the collective narrative of each group in the Israeli society. A sense of mutual belonging, a joint vocabulary, if you will. A way for all citizens to exist together without being held hostage to the non-solution situation that we're facing. Steps need to be taken to make it to make this a state for all of its citizens. Yeah, maybe first and foremost to try to change the attitude toward the Arab community inside of Israel. I deeply believe that making the Arab population an equal stakeholder in the community is a better means to make it a better community for all. Here we come in, the Abraham Fund, and I hope I have enough time to talk about the very important work that we do. The Abraham Fund is a policy think tank which advocates and its recommendations through large-scale action. Example, we believe that language and knowing the culture is one bridge to give a better life and get people to low down their barriers towards each other. So we started the Ya Salaam program in Arab schools. We now are in the Jewish schools. Around 200 of the Jewish schools today learn in Arabic, spoken Arabic, and about Arabic culture, which is included in the curriculum that we built for this program. So we're kind of getting to influence one way or another about 24,000 students. And the beauty of it all, that today it's 95% funded by the Ministry of Education. Statistics and research that we did to follow up on this showed that this kind of thing, and we're mirroring it in Arab schools, teaching more about Jewish culture and Jewish-spoken Hebrew in elementary schools, showed that this does contribute very positively to enhancing tolerance of the different population. We run projects, these kinds of projects, also in... I know my time is up, probably. No? Yeah, I'll have another minute.
This
if you
is
will.
For the kids, of course.
We run a program through three university campuses to try and help making the campuses a shared space. Also, in other leadership academies, we are into police, Arab community relations, economic development, and employment initiatives. And one of other most prized projects is Partner in Life, Sharikat Haya, of women empowerment that really was adopted by the state now and is fully implemented by the state now. Even in these dire times, and this is very important, so I'm going to take 30 seconds more. These are dire times, and I mean, I have to go home to that. For us, it's very personal. It's our everyday life. My office is in Haifa, so it's a mixed city. And so we deal with each other on a daily basis. It's at these times that we understand and believe that we have to keep our eyes on the prize and work even harder to make Israel a country for all of its citizens, with a strong, multicultural, and diverse democracy that treats every citizen equally and fairly. A democracy is often measured by how it treats its minorities. And treating equally and fairly is good for all Israelis. Thank you.
Thank you to Bashair Fahum Jayusi. I'm trying to think about a Jewish Zionist thinker that can represent all our three distinguished speakers. Can be one Jewish that represents all of them. And I found one, and you will see that we are not talking here about this format of speaking in Israel of left or right. This is not an issue of left or right, because the thinker is Vladimir Ze'ev Jabotinsky. And first of all, Miki, to you, I want to say that if Jabotinsky would be alive and will be prime minister on the establishment of the state, the complex of Ben-Gurion adapting the Millet system wouldn't happen. It will be totally separate between religion and state. This is one thing that we need to know. And Dr. Avraham Negosa, determination of your determination, personal determination, and determination of the Ethiopian community, the connection, the implementation of a connection of 1,000 years to the land of Israel is Jabotinsky. And last but not least, Bashair Fahum Jayusi, I want for you to quote Jabotinsky on minority-majority relation. As you all know, Jabotinsky believed in the state of Israel and the two sides of the Jordan, and it was before the Holocaust that he wrote, it will be 80% Jews and 20% Arabs. And if the head of state will be Jewish, which is more likely 80%, always in accordance to the constitution, his deputy should be Arab. But if the head of state, the elected office state, will be Arab, because Jabotinsky never thought that in the Jewish state, after the discrimination all over and everything, we will create a nation state that not every citizen could be elected to every position. So he said, if the head of state will be Arab, the deputy should be Jewish. Thank you very much, and we are to open and to hear you. We collect several comments and questions. Please do it short, not like me. And I am a rabbi, you know, I can't do it. So, please. Vakasha, please.
My name is Deborah Goldstein. I'm the director of Plan Giving and Endowments in Northeastern New York. I'm going to direct my question to, I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Bashar.
You indicated that 31% of the Arab students are passing the Bogrut. Yeah. Is there some way to identify why they are successful as opposed to the others, and is there something that we can do to make more of the kids?
The situation of the... we're going to take them seriously, hopefully, yeah.
This is a simple answer.
It's the difference between the education system. When you're talking about public schools, and these are about public schools, when you're talking about public schools in Israel and public Arab schools, the density of the students per class is very high. The buildings and everything that has to go, the labs, everything has to go to it, are very poor. So the welfare of the student is much lower than in Jewish public schools. So that's something that needs to be worked out. Also, there is a problem in the allocation of hours, teaching hours. And, you know, when you have 40 students in a classroom, it's very hard to go through and give individual care to each one. So you have the successful ones going and having their Bogrut, and you have the less successful not having a teacher being with them and, you know, give them the care that they need so they can get better and have Bogrut. This is one problem. The second problem is that we have in Arab schools, what you say, people dropping out of school. That's a high percentage of dropouts. It's because of economic reasons, basically, because people, children at that age, youngsters at that age, go to work. And that also, even youngsters going to school have to work maybe after hours because of economic problems. That's also a very big problem.
Toda rabba. Thank you very much. Please. Izhar S., the CEO of the Masorti movement in Israel.
Thank you, Rabbi.
That he chose some, for some reason, an Orthodox rabbi to officiate in his wedding.
My rabbi. Rabbi Rotenberg was my commander in the army and married us. It was a fascinating session, and thank you for showing us the diversity of the state of Israel. And I think that it was fascinating to see how each one of the leaders from each sector talked about the challenges within his own or her own sector. Yet, we need to think in a way that would empower all of us by working with sectors or between sectors. And therefore, I'd like to present a question to you, MK Nagosa. You are number 27 on the Likud list in the Knesset. You are a proud Likudnik. And I think that what Mickey Gitzin presented about the chief rabbinate has to do also with your community, due to the fact that many of your community, when they go to the chief rabbinate, they are considered as second-class Jews. And this means that we have two big sectors in Israel that are discriminated by this institution that has the monopoly, and I would love to see that in your term in the Knesset, you would help us and other to make sure that everything is, would be as open as it should be in a Jewish state.
Please.
Yes. Of course, Israel is a state for all its citizens. And I tell you why. I give you an example, is the Knesset. The Knesset is the best place to see that all the people, all the citizens are represented in the Knesset. You have the Jewish member of Knesset, you have Arab member of Knesset. On a religion aspect, if you go, you have a Christian have a Knesset. and you have Muslims and Jews. Therefore, in this situation, you can see. Now, coming to your question on the rabbinical issue, yes, there is a problem. My community also facing this problem. However, what we are doing it now is, concerning my community, is because of lack of interactions and lack of knowing well the community and its tradition led the chief rabbinate in that conclusion. However, as times going, and many young people of our community went to yeshivot, and they became now rabbis, and that problem is now decreasing. I'm not saying totally is removed, but today it is decreasing. The demand of symbolical conversion before marriage is now decreasing. Therefore, the recent comers in the last 20 years, the last comers are, of course, going through the symbolical conversion. And this situation is slowly changed as knowing an interaction between both sides. What I can do in the Knesset, first of all, it is my plan and vision that this problem will be solved so that all Jewish people will be recognized as equal. But I have to tell you, you mentioned I am in the Likud party, and we have a coalition with the religious parties. I am not telling you that we are going to touch the status quo. The status quo will continue. Otherwise, we will have a problem with coalitions. But there are ways that we can advance and change slowly the reality.
Toda Rabba. Thank you very much. Please.
Yoav from Rabbi Yoav from Hanaton Leadership Center in the Galil. I want to ask questions about different languages. You said that we don't have one civic language. You know, we read a few weeks ago in the Migdal Bavel, the Babylonian tower, that when God wanted to destroy our people, he gave them different languages. That's how dangerous different languages are. And here I think a lot of you spoke about different languages. So my question is this. Can we aspire to have one language in Israel? Safachat you, Rav Rotenberg. Safachat v'dvarim achadim. Or we have to give up that dream because we are a diverse society. By the way, I'm not sure that Israelis and Jews in the diaspora speak the same language. I'm trying to struggle for that, but sometimes it's not so clear. So what is our ideal? Should we try to speak one language and have a common denominator? Or should we say we speak different languages? That's the beauty of it. But somehow we have to make sure we understand each other's languages, which I don't think really is the case today.
No, Mickey, Bakasha. Ah, you ask me? Okay. The common language needs to be the civic language. You can believe or not believe, you can belong, be Arab, Jew, Palestinian, whatever, in every community. You can be Masorti, Reformi, Yehudi, Orthodoxy, whatever. The common language is the civic language. And as an outcome from the civic language is the equal rights of every group to practice their own way in the Jewish nation state. The idea of a Jewish nation state, that it's a democratic state, that every Jewish community, and by the way, I had before a small talk with the Knesset member Negosa, and we disagree about a point because, to my personal opinion, every community, including the Ethiopian community, had to come with their tradition and to continue their tradition and the religious leadership in Israel. This is my opinion. This is not the reality in Israel. And it's very far because it's not on the agenda, not the problem of the religious and coalition, all this. It's not, it never was really on the agenda of except one Meretz party, except Meretz party. It's not on the political agenda of any other party in the Knesset. So this is the situation, and we agree. If somebody wants to add,
you just said disagree. Good things about Meretz, I can't keep going.
I said good thing? It's not judgmental. I said the fact.
Vice versa, I respect.
Okay. Please.
Hi. Thank you all so much for coming to speak to us. My name is Amna Faruqi. I'm a senior at the University of Maryland. I'm also the president of J Street U. And we're really excited to be here. I actually spent...
if you can a little bit more slowly for us, I mean.
Totally fine.
You are young, long time young.
So my parents... I'm not Jewish. My parents aren't Jewish, but I've spent a lot of time in Israel. And my parents are from Pakistan. And one of the most amazing experiences that I had this summer in Israel was actually having a Shabbat dinner with an Indian Jewish family in Ramla. And it was a wonderful opportunity to go and actually talk to them about what life is like in Israel as a minority, and how they appreciate life in Israel, but also the struggles that they face with life in Israel. And it really made me appreciate that the strength of Israel is really in its diversity and in its vibrant Jewish life. But I also spent a lot of time in Israel going into the West Bank and meeting with Palestinian families and talking to them about their lives and the struggles that they face and how many of them don't receive even water or services because their lives are under occupation. And so it's wonderful here to hear about all the speakers' plans to promote democracy within Israel. But my question for everyone is, how can we be maintaining Israeli democracy when there's an occupation and Palestinians in the West Bank can't even vote for the government that controls their lives?
Who wants to reply to this?
For us, it's quite easy.
I don't want to reply to us. Okay, please.
The answer, I'm not answering from a position of my organization. I would answer, of course, a personal answer. Of course, the occupation has a major impact on Israel's democracy. And if Israel wants to remain the democracy, it does need to realize the fact that the occupation has a major impact on it and end it. It's quite an easy answer from my perspective, but the political situation, of course, is way more difficult than what can I express as an individual living in Israel. So the answer is yes, I agree with you.
I don't have a much smarter answer. I agree. The occupation, not only does it affect the democracy, it has this degenerating effect to the morals of the Israeli society. And we have been witnessing that over and over again. And my fear is that the manifests of that are getting closer and closer together. Once it was once in 5 years or 2 years or 1 year. Nowadays, it's once in a few months. And it has this overall effect on our lives. So I personally would totally agree with you. But again, somebody should do something about it.
Please.
I have a different opinion. I think Israel is the only democratic country in the Middle East. And Israel is a democratic state. First of all, as you said, the vision of Jabotinsky is happening now in the Knesset of Israel. The vice chairman of the Knesset is Arab, where the chairman is a Jew. So Israel is a democratic country, gives that representation for all parties. I think the word occupation is a little bit misinterpretation. Judea Samaria is part of the state of Israel. Therefore, a democratic Israel is a democratic state. The Arabs who are citizens of the state of Israel are represented in a democratic state. So this is my opinion.
1 minute, but the question, I like to represent you a little bit, okay? You allow me? Okay, thank you. But the question was, and let's make it like this. You have few millions of human beings under our government, I don't say your government, our government, without any civil rights. So this is a huge question to our being a democracy. How you answer this?
No. This is what Israel, I'm talking, it is citizens. And those who are, is they have their own autonomy, which Israel is recognizing that autonomy. And so that has to be solved with a peace treaty between the two sides. When there is a real leadership who can deal and sit and discuss a peace treaty with our leaders, then that will be the final solution.
Okay, thank you. Bashar, you want to add? So you can use his you can use the micro from the right.
Yeah, I'm a little puzzled because I have to say this is new to me, and I live in Israel. Judea and Samaria are under occupation, as a matter of law. This is the situation. Actually, if we want to claim otherwise, that means that we have to change the law. And that's a huge step that up till now, even we've heard things about it, have not been done. So it is occupation, I'm sorry. Its name is occupation, and the people living there have no civil rights, and the Palestinian Authority even, and it's not an autonomy, as you said, and I'm sorry, this is not the situation. And these people are not citizens of the state of Israel.
Thank you. You see, we felt a little bit the spirit of the conversation of Yamin v'Smol, right and left. And to take us at and go back to the civil society issue, I want to remind us all that not only the grandpa and grandma of Bashar, but all Arabs in Israel till 1964 were under military government within Israel. This wasn't occupied territories, as we call it today. Military government, personal. If you were Arab, not matter where you are under military government. And who fought? This was Ben-Gurion government, you know. And who fought with all his power against the military government that were demolished, if I'm not mistaken, by 64? Who? Menachem Begin. So it's not a question of right and left. It's a question, we speak here about foundation of democratic and Jewish values. Oh, please, yes.
Hi, my name is Loi Badir. I'm also from Israel. I'm an
We didn't get your name.
Yeah, Sadio, I know it's complicated. Loi.
No.
Loi, yes.
Loi, okay.
Exactly. I'm a Wexner Fellow. I work for the government. I'm a sports supervisor in the Ministry of Culture and Sport in Israel. And unfortunately, in some data, I disagree with Bashar, and I will ask you later about that. So I need to make a comment because it's turned me on every time we talk about diversity and about Jew and Arab in Israel. I care about the 2.5 million Arab Israeli inside Israel, not about the Palestinians. So for decades, we have Arab Israeli Knesset members who should represent us, Bashar. And for decades, they've done nothing for our society. I can't give you data, okay? I work for the government also. So do you know how many Arab Israeli Knesset members we have today in the Knesset? 13. Do you know what... 15, okay. Do you have... No, I'm talking about the one party of the... Yes. Yeah. So do you know what is their weight in the Knesset? Zero. Okay? And I want your comment about that.
Well, I'll start and then they'll get it. First of all, I don't know about what data you have. The representatives in the Knesset, the Arab MKs, have been representing me as a member of their constituency for years now. Knesset research shows that Arab MKs even excel at doing what they do in parliament, in parliamentary work. For 2 years, I think MKTB was voted best parliamentary best in parliamentary action, and he's an Arab MK, as you probably know. The thing is that the claim is, and this is talking a little bit internally about Israeli politics. I don't know how much that will relate to most of you, but we hear it a lot in the media that Arab MKs do absolutely nothing for their constituency, and that's very misleading because the opposite is right, and research that even we did in the Abraham Fund showed that the most of the Arab voters, we do work to encourage a political participation of the Arab community in Israel. We actually have, we're nonpartisan, of course, but we actually work for people to just go and put their ballots because we believe that that's an integral part of being an Israeli citizen. So we do research also towards that, and research that we did with the Institute for Democracy, IDI, showed that first, most Arabs, the majority of Arabs think that Arab MKs do represent them. And second, we looked into the Arab MKs' work in parliament and found that they do work on the issues and the concerns of the Arabs within Israel. Now, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is more vocal. I mean, it's more mirrored in the media, and whenever you speak about it, you get more coverage. And it's more provocative and controversial. And that's why maybe to the ear it sounds otherwise. But research shows, data shows that that's not true.
Please.
Yes, my name is Leon Raven. I'm from Lexington, Kentucky. The main topic of this session is the problem of pluralism and its acceptance in Israeli society. And we're often given the answer, as we have, that, well, Israel's a democracy, so it should be able to solve this problem. What we've heard is not very optimistic. But from an American perspective, we don't really see a democracy as representing or giving a chance to pluralism. Democracy is more can be more like mob rule. And in a way, we see that happening Israel and its coalitions. The answer that we see is in constitutional guarantees. So my question is, and Israel does not have a constitution, and I think that's the biggest problem here. So my question is, are there any moves in Israel? Are there people thinking that this is really the way to go here, that we need to establish a constitution? We'll never solve it by majorities or majority coalitions.
Okay, I'll try to answer this question about the constitution in Israel. There was a long time discussion, and it still exists on the ground, on solving the Israeli political or internal political problem through constitution. Of course, constitution could be one of the solutions, but I want to take it in one step upper strategically. They try sometimes to think that we can copy one of the systems outside of Israel and make the Israeli system same as, for example, the American system, let's say complete separation of church and state as it is now in the American system, or a thing that the same solution will be good for Israel and other countries. It's actually not true. There are different ways to go and different countries with different models of democracy. Part of them, by the way, do not have constitution till today. Take the UK as an example of a country that has the Magna Carta, but doesn't have a clear constitution as the American government has. By the way, the Queen of England is the head of the Anglican Church, officially, and still, there is a clear division in rights. I'm talking about rights and freedom of religion in the UK. So there are, and I can give you the German example, that within the constitution there is a religious tension and so on. So I think that when we talk about what kind of a model of religion and state affairs or how do we ensure pluralism, we don't necessarily have to go to the American model, but we do need to think what will be the best solution for the unique situation in which Israel is part of. And I think constitution could be one of the answer, but definitely not the only one.
Toda rabba.
Yeah, I have a question. First, I just want to say...
A name.
Oh, I'm Julie Kriegel from Silicon Valley. I wanted to ask Bashar a question. Actually, I first want to just say that I believe in a two-state solution. I believe it's an occupation, and I want to see that solved somehow. But I have a question for you, Bashar, about the educational piece and something that's concerned me very much recently. And that is that even though there's an understanding among Jews about the Arab history and the indigenous people who've always lived there, there doesn't seem to be a parallel understanding about the Jewish history to the land and the connection to the land. Jews are viewed as colonialists, imperialists who've invaded, they're crusaders. There isn't the understanding in the schools. And I remember being in Israel just about a year and a half ago and talking to a woman whose children went to an Arab school, and she said they knew absolutely nothing about the fact that there had been approximately a million Jews from Arab lands who were forced to leave without their money, without their possessions, without their belongings, without anything. And where did they run to? They went to Israel. And there were approximately a million Arabs, of course, who also fled during the, I'm talking about the Independence War now, the time in 1948. That there doesn't seem to be an understanding of that parallel history. And I'm curious both if you think yourself, do you believe that Jews have that very indigenous Zionist right to the land? And do you believe that the Arab communities understand that history as well? And are they being taught it? When you say they're being taught Jewish history, is that the history they're being taught, the real history?
Forgive me for interrupting and change a little bit. There is no obligation of any of the panelists to say what they believe themselves. They analyze, and that's enough, okay?
Okay, but please, if you'd like to answer the question, I'd appreciate it.
It's a mandatory curricula in Arab schools to teach Jewish history, all Jewish history. There's a mandatory teaching of Tanakh, part Talmud, and we have even compulsory tests as part of the matriculation in these subjects. When we're talking about civics, a huge part of civics is the Jewish history. So if you ask me if we know the narrative, if the Arabs know the narrative, they definitely do. They get tested in it. Whether they identify with that in that sense, that's a more complex question. And if I can go back a little bit to some of the assumptions that you have in your questions, one of them being that the Jewish majority has an understanding of what the Arabs went through. I have to say that is not... I mean, that would be a little bit optimistic if I could agree with you about that, because that only means that at least we have the equal grounds that we can talk. And then talk to me about believing, not believing, justifying, not justifying. But let's... You know, let's start with knowing. So I'm afraid to tell you that the Jewish majority does not know the Palestinian narrative. And those that might know some of the innuendos around it reject it, including rejecting the notion that of the 1 million Palestinians you just said that fled in 48. So that's a huge controversial issue in Israel. Children grow up not knowing that. That is not being taught in any school. So not even that. I want to share a personal experience with you. This is very important, I think.
Okay, please.
It was overwhelming for me and... I used to sit on the board of the University of Haifa. I sat there for 9 years, 10 years. And one of the board members, a prominent Jew living in Tel Aviv, head of one of the biggest banks in Israel. So we had a personal meeting one time, and he just looked at me straight in the eyes, and he told me, "Do you know that my son, now going from 26 to 27, it was his 27th birthday,
Today is his birthday. Do you know that he never met an Arab in his life, and he lives in Tel Aviv? He never met an Arab throughout his life. I mean, you can be a Jew in Israel and go through a lifetime and meet Arabs only as vendors in shops, or maybe working in restaurants, or maybe a pharmacist here and there, or maybe a doctor that's giving you treatment in a hospital, but not have a meaningful encounter with an Arab. And this is a 27-year-old child that he was talking about. So this is the experience in Israel, and that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Bevakasha, Chaver HaKnesset.
I just want to say one sentence on this. Just last week, member of Knesset, Arabs and Jews together unanimously passed a law to educate in the education system Hebrew and Arabic obligations. Yes. Yes.
Thank you very much.
I want to say something as someone that went to school in Israel my entire life. The only time that you start learning about Arabs, that you it's the point that you start learning about Fadayuns, meaning like when the terror answer to the Jewish militias started, we knew nothing. It was from the Tanakh to the Palmach, meaning when the Tanakh was around, and then the Jewish militia started. We knew nothing about what happened in the land of Israel beforehand. We don't learn it at school at all.
I want to share with you a story of a person who went to Mamlachti school Geulim in Baka in Jerusalem before 67, you know. And in every class in our school, we have Arabs from Beit Tzafafa and other parts of before 67 Jerusalem. And we knew a lot. We visited them at their home. And I lived in Baka in a building of five apartments. Two apartments were Arabs and three apartments by Jews. And we lived together all the time. And this was Israel before 67. So I have different, two young children in Israel, different experience. So the personal story is nice. We like here in the GA mainly personal stories, but are not to learn something. It's enjoyable, but to learn from personal story, not so much. Okay, please.
I'm Jerry Fisher, Executive Director of the Jewish Federation in Eastern Connecticut, and I have a question for the Likud MK and for the representative of the Abraham Fund. We're trying, I think all of us here in this gathering would like to see a better civil society in Israel. So the question for the Likud MK is, under the previous government, which admittedly did not have any religious parties in it at all, they drafted Orthodox Jews into the army, and they, the Knesset, passed penalties for those that refused to register for the induction into the army. So my question for you is, will you encourage your party to continue to support that law and make sure that Orthodox young men who do not register for the army face a penalty? And for the representative of the Abraham Fund, do you see in the future for your organization any possibility of advocating for the Arab Israelis to be part of national service or eventually the IDF as another way of fully integrating into Israel? Thank you.
Please.
Regarding this issue, we know that all Israeli citizens should give services for the state, including the Haredim. Go to the army like any other citizens. This is, I accept. However, we should not do it by force. We have to do it in consensus and agreement and dialogue with the people, and they accept it. I think this is much good result than by forcing it, because today we have many thousands of Haredim soldiers in the Israeli Defense Force. And we have to encourage that in dialogue, in agreement, not by force.
Thank you very much. Mashaya, please.
I think there is a precondition in your, also in your question, that I need to address. When we talk about enlisting for the army now, I'm talking about IDF and not national service. It's two different, separate, not really separate, but really two answers. First, it's not on the table right now in the sense of not politically and not in on the agenda, and this is not the something that the state wants or the Palestinians in Israel want at this stage. I don't know if that will ever happen, but there is a small case of my country fighting my countrymen involved. I mean, and that makes that a clear-cut answer as to that. But as to a national service, the notion of national service nowadays in the Arab community is not accepted. Although, given that, the notion of social responsibility and the need to volunteer for your own community is very much on the agenda. It's a matter of consensus in mainstream Arab community. So that is on our agenda as the Abraham Fund. We do a lot of programs that involve youngsters between the age of 18 and 24. We have something new. This is what I said about the invisible generation. This is the generation in the Arab community that is most at risk, that mostly have nothing to do because most of them do not pursue education. There's a huge unemployment problem in that age. They don't have the skills to be accepted in the workplace. And so that is one main thing that we have very strongly on our agenda.
Toda raba. Please.
So I guess you heard from Naftali earlier that I take positions. So I'm going to go ahead and ask you, Chaka Nagosa, about your position, putting aside for the moment the realities of coalition politics, which we all understand are complicated and messy and challenging. But from a philosophical standpoint, just purely philosophical, do you see anything wrong with having an alternative system in Israel to the current status quo, which is controlled by the Rabbanut, which is very challenging, if not impossible, for many Israelis on all personal status issues? Do you see an alternative, and what does it take to get to that alternative? Thank you.
Well, this issue is that I said earlier also, I mean, every citizen has its right or his right or her right to determine the way how to live in Israel.
I'm sorry, but that's not true.
No, I am saying that it should have, okay? It shouldn't. You see, I should not be complicated with my coalition parties. So I am telling you my personal positions. You asked me my personal position, so I'm giving you my personal position. In my personal position is that every citizen should have his own right to determine how he lives in Israel. Israel is for all its citizens. Seculars, religious, Haredim, Arabs, Muslims, Christians, Druzim, all can live in peace together, and they can live the way they practice their life and in the religious aspect and other ways of life. This is what I believe.
Keep the microphone, because now I have a question. I was asked to ask a question, every one of you, and you have like 1 minute to answer. You have here distinguished representatives of all federations, professional and lay, sitting here. What you can tell them that you need their help or their activity or their support for your own activities. please, Knesset member, you are the first.
The activity in the Knesset?
What you now talk to the Federation, the people of the Federation, Jewish Federation of North America, what kind of activity support you want them to engage? I ask Beseda.
Yeah, I think the Jewish Federations had played a vital role in the past, and they're continuing to play a role in the life in Israel. I mean, being supporting and being stand on the side of Israel, whether it is in the absorption of immigrants or other issues. So we have in the social issues, you can always continue to open projects, educational projects, and help the Israeli government as filling the gap that the Israeli government is doing. You can always come and help. So this is the kind of thing I would prefer that the federations continue to play as they did in the past.
Thank you very much, Bashar, please. Which is not representative of every fund. She's co-chair of every fund.
what we do at the Abraham Fund, we do very passionately and very in a personal way. We're very much invested in what we do. For me personally, I didn't come here. I don't go and speak to people in order to win an argument. I go into it because this is my life. This is my daughter's life. And I know the role that the Jewish community had in civil rights movements. You have the experience. You have the history that can really, really be utilized in our line of work. Somebody said, you, sir, I think that we're not optimistic. We are born optimistic. We have to be. This is not a choice for me. I don't have the privilege of being a pessimist. None of my peers have that privilege. Yeah, I know what you meant, but I just used it to make a point. So please help us. We need your expertise. We need your voice with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Miki Gitzin, please.
So I think I said it quite clear earlier by saying and calling the topic that I'm dealing with a Jewish issue, not an Israeli one, but a Jewish one. And if it's a Jewish issue, we all need to act on it together. Because if we are not going to act on it together, we're going to stay in the same situation in which we are today. And actually, the Federation system on this issue took an action. They created IRAP, which Susie chairs, and it's a way and a path to support the work that we are doing on religious freedom and religious pluralism. There is a clear way for you to act today and join this institution and help our work. But our work does not mean Israelis. It means Jews around the world that believe in more progressive, pluralistic society in Israel and the Jewish world. So this is what I would offer.
Thank you very much. Before I thank the participants, I have a personal announcement. We used to say shtika kehaskama, keeping silence is like consent. In my case, I want to say I heard many things, and in your case, those who wanted to speak and didn't express themselves, I want to say here shtika lo kehaskama. Keeping silence, it's not that we agree. We are separate with wonderful love and love for disagreement. Toda rabba lekulam.